Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In testimony on the Senate Judiciary Committee, or before the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing in the nomination of Elena Kagan to be an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States, Fernande Duffley, on behalf of the National Association of Women Judges, said this: "The advancement of women in the legal profession has not been rapid nor inevitable, but we are now past celebrating our firsts. We look forward to celebrating full diversity on our nation's courts." Today, we're going to talk about the trajectory of women in the legal profession, the speed and likelihood of advancement in light of this anticipated first, the first time there will be three women at once on the nation's highest court. In a few minutes, we'll meet with Ohio Supreme Court Justice Maureen O'Connor and Jennifer Bruner, a former Common Pleas judge and now Ohio's first female Secretary of State. Right now, Dayton Daily News reporter Mary McCarty is with us from Dayton. She wrote about what sort of impression the confirmation hearings in Washington made on an assortment of esteemed female judges in Ohio. Welcome to the show, Mary.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
What were the thoughts behind doing the story in the first place?
Well, actually, we did write it in advance of the hearings. It appeared the Sunday before Elena Kagan's nomination.
So it was the testimony from Sonia Sotomayor.
Yeah, okay. We were, you know, interested in some of the language surrounding her nomination and confirmation, and some of that drumbeat seemed to be starting up again that struck us as possible code words. For instance, oddly, Sotomayor was derided by some for being too empathetic, you know, like that's a character flaw instead of, you know, a basic tenet of human dignity and decency. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of us felt, you know, could that be a code word for woman? And so we thought it'd be interesting to talk to some of our local and statewide judges and justices, including someone who I quoted extensively, very articulately, was one of your other guests, Justice Maureen O'Connor, you know, and as women and judges, you know, what are their perceptions about this? Were they dreading, looking forward to the hearings? So that was the genesis of the article.
What was the general tenor of their responses?
Well, I would summarize it as saying, yes, they had, you know, some concerns surrounding the language. I think some of them were dreading the confirmation hearings just a bit because of that. And yet there was a lot of optimism and a sense of celebration that, you know, here, you know, we could have for the first time three women on the nation's highest court. And, you know, some of the experts even thought we're really not that far away from a time when, you know, you and I won't even be discussing an issue like this, be a non-issue.
It's another first of that. It's the first time that two women have been nominated in a row.
Yes, that's true as well. So certainly a very hopeful trend that's beginning to reflect what's already happening in our law schools, where I think women constitute, you know, at least half of law students at most law schools these days.
How does Ohio stack up in terms of the number of female judges serving on the bench right now?
Well, I just happen to have those numbers handy, I believe. Okay. Well, let's see. By the numbers, we have 24.8% of federal judges at all levels are women, and 24% of district court judges are women, almost 27% of circuit court judges are women. Actually, in Cincinnati Sixth Circuit, it's better than that, 5 out of 15, and that's 33%. Now, in Ohio, Ohio really is just about on par with national averages is 25%, and compared with 24.7% in the U.S. So now, pretty dead on, I would say.
So, like circuit and federal, those are appointments.
Correct.
So that's not leaving it up to the vagaries of the voting public.
in that case, no. And now, interestingly, in Montgomery County, where we are, it's dead even, 50% women, 50% men on the bench in Montgomery County.
And so. What are your thoughts about that? Why do you think that is? Because that's way out of whack.
I guess Dayton, you know, voters are just exceptionally progressive.
Because then we are talking about voters.
Yeah, we are talking about voters here. And, you know, I think, you know, you got to give credit to a lot of the candidates, strong candidates stepping forward and running good, strong campaigns. So I really don't know how to interpret that. I'd like to believe that, you know, we here in Dayton are especially enlightened, but I think it probably a lot more of the credit goes to the candidates themselves.
Just sticking their neck out in the first place.
Yeah, and doing the job.
Did you talk with any of them about what inspired them to seek that office?
I did, you know, and it was interesting. I remember speaking with Ohio Supreme Court Justice Landinger, and she said, you know, when I didn't ask how old she was, but, you know, when she was younger, you know, being a lawyer wasn't even an option for her. And, you know, she never would have dreamed that she'd be on, you know, Ohio Supreme Court. And yet, and her mother, who I guess died a week after she was sworn in, you know, lived long enough to see her daughter in that role. And, of course, that was a big thrill.
So it's not something girls grow up – or does anybody grow up dreaming to be a judge? I don't know. Maybe president or an astronaut.
I don't know. But, you know, I mean, for women even, you know, of a certain age, and it's not that old of an age, that just wouldn't have been within the realm of possibility.
We have Mary McCarty, with us on the phone from the Dayton Daily News. She's a reporter there. She wrote about in advance of the Elena Kagan confirmation hearings in the Senate Judiciary Committee. She wrote about it and talked with judges from around the state, including U.S. Supreme Court Justice Maureen O'Connor, who is in the studio with me today, and she will be joining us after the next break. And also with us today, Jennifer Bruner, Ohio Secretary of State. She'll be joining us as well in a few minutes. If you want to talk with Mary McCarty of the Dayton Daily News, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Mary, what did anybody say what did inspire them, that they just someone encouraged them to do it, or they thought it would be fun, or after practicing law for a while, it looked like something good to do?
Well, I think, of course, you know, going back to the early 80s now, mm-hmm. when President Ronald Reagan nominates Sandra Day O'Connor, that was extremely inspirational to a lot of the women. And in fact, one of our local Montgomery County judges, Mary Kate Huffman, remembered meeting Sandra Day O'Connor some years later, and, you know, just what a groundbreaking thing that was to her. But then, interestingly, when I talked to Lori Shaw, who's a law professor at University of Dayton College of Law, her young students, you know, don't even, you know, find it hard to believe there was a day when we didn't have a woman on the Supreme Court. So, you know, that's just a span of, you know, less than 30 years, and that kind of sea change has occurred. But I do think her nomination was very inspirational to a lot of the women that are currently on the bench.
Was she the first woman to be nominated?
Well, she certainly was the first woman to be confirmed.
Right.
And I believe she was the first woman to be nominated. But I will make a disclaimer here that I'm not really
right.
a Supreme Court expert.
No, I should have checked on that first. But I think she was the first woman to even be nominated. Do you have any sense about how the tenor of the hearings has changed, evolved, or devolved over since Sandra Day O'Connor? Back in that day, it didn't seem as contentious as they do these days.
I would say that's more of a general political change, perhaps, from those days. You know, again, we haven't had that many women on the bench, so, you know, some of this, again, I felt, you know, some of the questioning of Sotomayor had some little, you know, potential undercurrents of sexism. Now, one of the things that was brought out, I believe our Judge Barbara Gorman here, and several others mentioned that when you use words like soft or empathetic, you know, it could be code for woman, but it could also be code word for liberal. So they had a little hard time, you know, deciphering that, you know, whether it was meant to be a dig at the Democrats or, you know, trying to subtly imply that, that women were somehow not hard-nosed enough for the job.
But no question it was a dig, in her opinion?
Well, I think, I mean, that empathetic was definitely put out as a criticism. And again, this Lori Shaw, who's a professor of lawyering skills at UD College of Law, she said, you know, the best judges I know, male and female, temper justice with mercy. And, you know, she found it very interesting. She was criticized for that because that's a pretty basic construct, you know, that you consider the human element when you're on the bench.
Just have a few more minutes with Mary McCarty of the Dayton Daily News. If you want to talk to her about female judges in Ohio and around the country, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page, too, if that is your preferred mode of communication. If you want to see Mary McCarty's story, we'll have a link to it on our website, wosu.org/allsides. Mary, what was there any feeling about doing a follow-up story on all of this, given the?
Well, I would like to myself do a follow-up, and just, you know, after this is over. Now, of course, her hearings have kind of taken a back seat in a way to the oil spill and other big news. I don't think they've attracted as much attention as Sonia Sotomayor's confirmation hearings. But yeah, I would like to check back with some of the women I spoke with and see what they thought about the hearings and the tenor of the hearings.
Musa? Did I pronounce your name correctly, Musa? Hello? Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hi. I'm sorry. I don't know how to pronounce your name. So is it Musa?
Musa, yes. M-U-S-A.
Oh, M-U-S-A. You want to ask, why are Republicans afraid of educated women? Do you think that's what it's about?
I think, I mean, when you really listen to, whenever there is a liberal woman appointed to the Supreme Court, there is huge noise about, you know, he's too educated, he's a liberal, he's that. What is wrong with being a liberal?
Mm-hmm. Well, if you disagree philosophically with him. Mary, do you think it was a matter of Republicans being afraid of educated women?
Well, no, I personally don't think that. I mean, certainly, you know, there are many Republican appointees. I mean, you know, Sandra Day O'Connor was the Republican appointee way back in the day. And so I personally wouldn't attribute that. You know, I think people in political situations use, you know, any tools that they have. And, you know, if they think that there's a perception that women aren't going to be as qualified, they might subtly try to use that tool. I think Democrats are perfectly capable of doing the same kind of thing. And sometimes even sexism is not necessarily a conscious or intentional thing also, you know, that, you know, that's why I think it's good to be discussing these issues and maybe making people more sensitive to the way language is used.
All righty. Mary McCarty of the Dayton Daily News, thanks so much for joining the show today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I appreciate it.
And we'll, thanks for your call, Musa.
Yeah, Musa, thanks for your call.
All right.
Take care.
All
righty. We are going to take a quick break. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
You're listening to WOSU 820 NPR News. And at noon today, Fresh Air will be here when director Lisa Shalodenko decided to write a movie about teens tracking down their father, an anonymous sperm donor. She didn't realize her co-writer had once donated sperm himself.
It was interesting because I had, you know, been in the world of looking for a sperm donor, but I had never actually met a sperm donor. So there he was, and he was my friend. I had known him for many years.
The director of the new movie, The Kids Are All Right, will be on Fresh Air with Terry Gross at noon, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. 88 degrees in downtown Columbus. Sunny skies today, a high of 95. A chance of rain tonight, a low of 71. Cooler for Friday, cloudy skies and a chance of rain with a high of 82. And for tomorrow night, a chance of rain, a low of 62 degrees. All Sides continues on WOSU 820, NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. If you want to join the conversation, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. If you would like to speak to Ohio Supreme Court Justice Maureen O'Connor, welcome to the show, Judge.
Thank you. Thank you
and
very much.
Also Jennifer Bruner, Ohio Secretary of State. Jennifer Bruner, she's Ohio's first female Secretary of State, but you're also a judge from Franklin County Common Police Court.
Formerly, yes.
Good morning. The issue of empathy, as Mary McCarty from the Dayton Daily News mentioned, comes up a lot. It's the code word. Justice O'Connor, what does empathy mean to you as a longtime judge, a prosecutor, and whatnot?
I think, Anne, that the word is coming up because that's the word that President Obama used when asked about his future choices for the United States Supreme Court and the appointment to the federal judiciary. And he said he would look for judges that portray or have empathy. And I'm sure what he meant by that, and I think what the word means is a sensitivity to not just the strict constraints of the law, but the human element that enters into the decisions that the judiciary has to make. I've always been a big believer that it's the trial judges that utilize the empathy element in their role as members of the judiciary on the trial level because, you know, they can fashion solutions along with, you know, the parties and their counsel. And empathy can enter very much does so with the solutions that those judges are able to fashion, especially in the area of juvenile law and family law.
Jennifer Bruner, did that feel like that's what you were using as a judge? You were employing your empathetic skills at times and that does come into play and it's valid?
There's a balance. Interestingly, when new judges actually go through training through the Ohio Supreme Court, one of the things that they did with me and my fellow judges in 2000 was to actually analyze or assess us with the Myers-Briggs personality test so that we understood if we were a little too far on the analytical side or on the sensing side, and so that we would understand where we may be weak, where we may be strong, because empathy is something that's needed, but it can't be weighted too heavily with the other things that are needed to make a fair decision.
So it's a code word. Were there any other code words that popped up for you during these hearings, Justice O'Connor?
I think that, you know, empathy was the number one word that was utilized in the most recent hearings with Elena Kagan. Humor was one of the focal points of articles about her.
Right.
And that came, I'm sure, as a surprise to the questioners and the viewing public and, of course, the media. And they honed in on that where empathy was the buzzword when you were talking about the Sotomayor. But in Elena Kagan, it was intelligence, smart, and they added humor to it. And what a great sense of humor, which is certainly the antithesis of what most people would say that a woman in a black robe would possess and would be able to display.
And why is that? Why is that so surprising?
It's surprising. Why is it surprising for the public to think?
Yes.
Yeah. Because of the job that is necessary to be done. The image of the judiciary. And I have to say that the image of the judiciary is created in large part by the media and how judges are portrayed in movies, on television, in novels, and they're not accurately portrayed.
And they're given far more powers than they actually have in many instances. They're portrayed as either buffoons or curmudgeons or cold, unfeeling, or simply just whack jobs, depending on what show you're watching. And since very few people in the general public actually have contact with a member of the judiciary, they rely on those perceptions about the judiciary. And I don't think that does a very good service.
You know, sometimes when I'm watching television and watching a TV show and, you know, just even when I'm channel surfing, it seems like almost every crime or judicial type of show has a woman on the bench. It seems kind of out of whack, like they're sort of overcompensating, because clearly that's really not the case. It's a minority, right?
It still is.
Right.
When I left the bench in Franklin County in 2005, there were 17 judges in the general division, and my exit left the number of women in that court at two. So 15 men and two women. But I want to point out, if you coming in as a new judge, as I did in 2000, it was odd to think that I was the only one wearing a robe, that my seat was elevated higher than anyone else's, and that as I made decisions as a trial court judge, an entire audience could watch my face as I heard testimony or as I heard something in front of me from someone standing in handcuffs in front of me. And basically, your whole decision-making process, unless you take a break and go back to your chambers and think about things and look things up, especially when you're a trial judge, is right out there in front of everybody. It's a different kind of role.
Different than?
Well, than any other government servant who may be on some kind of a board or a commission, mm-hmm. Because they don't wear a costume and they're generally not elevated, and people don't generally stand up when they walk in the room, and they don't have the power to sign a piece of paper that puts someone in jail for a specified period of time.
There's a lot of symbolism associated with it. There's a lot of things, rights, deference given to judges that aren't given to other people. And I guess, it makes me feel like that inevitability, the point that was made during the hearings that it has not been rapid nor inevitable. And I wonder, what do you think about the word inevitable? I still am wondering, you mean it could be that we could be even worse off than we are now in terms of the numbers?
No, I think the inevitable is that the progress is inevitable that's the way I would look at it. I think it's inevitable that we will at one point, and I can't give you a timeline, mm-hmm. of when gender will not be a focus, where it will be commonplace. And, you know, you talk to students today, they don't remember a time when women were not on the bench. Here in Ohio, we have three members of a 7-member Supreme Court bench that are women. When I first took office in 2003, it gave Ohio the first ever female majority on the Ohio Supreme Court. That has since changed because one of the female members of the court went on to the Sixth Circuit. That was Deborah Cook, and she was replaced by a male. And his name was Terrence O'Donnell. And I said, if you just continue to go by Terry, maybe we can keep this.
No one will ever know.
Yeah. But that didn't happen. But if you look – if you look at the pool from which judges come, which is the bar, you want to take a look at what those percentages are. And we have almost 56,000 attorneys in the state of Ohio, and we have about 32% are women. And, you know, the rest, of course, are male. And you look at then the number of members of our judiciary. And in Ohio, we have about 25.3% of our state judiciary are women. So it's under the number of percentage-wise of women in the pool, but it's improving, I think.
It doesn't reflect the percentage of women in the pool. We've got about 50-50 women and men in law school right now.
Yeah.
But it always seems to sift out that a lot more men go on into law than women do, and then a higher percentage. Well, because 56,000 practicing, 32% are women. It's been 50-50 for long enough, hasn't it been? Or is that just a new phenomenon?
I don't think it's been 50-50 for that long. It certainly wasn't when I was in law school. I graduated in 1980. It's gotten, I think, maybe since the mid-90s, we're talking about a progress like
and
that.
And when you were in law school, you were one of just a handful? And did it feel like that?
No, there were a significant number in my class of women, and you know, I don't ever remember that being an issue. It truly wasn't. It wasn't for me. It wasn't for my classmates. But again, it wasn't 50-50 by a long shot. If it was 25%, that may have been more realistic.
What about you, Jennifer Berner, when you were in law school?
Well, I was about 3 years behind Justice O'Connor, and I was here in Columbus at Capitol Law School. I had the interesting experience of having a baby in law school 4 weeks before finals, my second year, second semester. And I recall that I had one professor who's no longer with us who managed to call on me first for an answer, and I gave the answer, and he said that wasn't quite right, and he went through about 10 more people and then eventually came back to the answer that I gave. And my classmates at the end of the class said, "Didn't you say that to him the first time?" I said, "Yes, I think so." But we had always been told that he didn't think that women really belonged in law school. And I was very obviously a woman at that point in time because I was quite pregnant. So, but all that seemed to dissipate when I showed up the next quarter of next semester with the baby in tow to register for my classes, and he thought she was so cute, so all was behind us at that point. I think because you have to be a lawyer for 6 years before you can be a judge, because you have women moving up and being in the profession for longer periods of time, although there is the issue for women about what to do during childbearing years, whether they continue to practice. And back when I was a law clerk, there was a woman attorney at one of the large firms here in town who had been the first woman in her firm to have a baby while she was working at the law firm, and they had to actually create a maternity leave policy for her. So you have those kinds of issues that do come into play, women having to make choices about how they want to handle their families. I mean, for me, what I did was I started a law practice out of the corner of my bedroom when my children were 7, 4, and 2, and that allowed me to still pursue my profession, but meet what I wanted to do with my family. And then when I was first asked to run for judge in 1992, like most women who are first asked to run for any political office, I felt that I wasn't far enough along in my career, that I had family issues, but this was the first time someone had specifically asked me. So I think that may lead into why it's a little bit lagging for women.
And you didn't take them up on that. The first time you were queried on it, you decided against it.
No, I waited 8 years, but that thought never left my head once someone suggested it to me.
What about you, Justice O'Connor? What inspired you to become a judge?
Well, as I tell law students and young lawyers, you just have to keep your options open, and please don't ever do anything that's going to close a door for an opportunity. That's how I've always approached life, and that's how I approached my career. I, graduated from law school, took the bar, started practicing law. There was an opening for a magistrate in probate court in Summit County, and they asked me to apply because I had practiced in that area. And not exclusively, I was doing criminal appointments. I was doing criminal trials as well. But I applied, and then that kind of progressed from being a magistrate to then running for the judiciary, then becoming a judge. And it was basically looking at the job from the inside as opposed to from the outside as a practitioner that I decided that I can do that job, and I would like to do that job. I find it intellectually stimulating. It's a challenge. You have an opportunity to truly be a meaningful public servant. And at the end of the day, you have the opportunity in any capacity as a judge to truly do good.
Let's listen to or read an email now from Brent. Oh, I guess it's on Facebook. Brent, this idea is 20 years late. If there were anything except women working in the legal and judicial professions, I'd be amazed. In fact, the story of the day is, what sort of man does it take to get hired in those professions today?
Well, I think the statistics certainly point exactly the opposite. You know, that's not the case. And it sounds to me that, you know, there might be other issues at work underlying that question. But, you know, if you want to look at Ohio and the progress through the ages, so to speak, in Ohio, the first woman to serve on a state Supreme Court was in Ohio, and that was Florence Allen. Right. She went on then to become a member of the federal bench by appointment, but that was 1922. And when you think of when women were able, you know, got the right to vote, and here in 1922, she's on the Ohio Supreme Court. So I believe that Ohio and Ohioans are progressive in this area. And I do agree with Jennifer that women have to and have recently, when I say recently, within the last 10 years or so, been coming of age and saying, yes, we can do that. And when they do attempt to run for office, there's a very good track record for women being elected in the judiciary. And then you also want to take a look at how we select our judiciary in this state, which is very different than many of the other states. There's political appointments. There's merit selection in other states. Mm-hmm. In other states, there's a process where you're appointed, then you're reappointed. You never face the voters. In Ohio, you face the voters. That's not the easiest task to take on. As Jennifer and I both, have run campaigns.
It's a whole other job to run for the office and then hold the office.
It is. And then when you hold the office and then to run for reelection, you're starting from ground zero again and going through the process. So that is not an appealing aspect of being a member of the bench. And people are very much put off by that, both men and women, saying, I don't want to run.
It's somewhat antithetical to being a judge, having to run for the job of judge.
As a trial court judge, it's good that you, if you run a strong campaign, especially if you're out doing what you're supposed to do in campaign, you actually see the areas of your jurisdiction and the people in your jurisdiction that you're going to be making decisions about in a very personal way. But when you get to the higher levels, I think that maybe we ought to be looking at some form of a hybrid, maybe a retention election. The former Chief Justice Moyer was really passionate about that, and I can understand that because otherwise there are some antithetical aspects to it.
Let's see. We're going to take a break right now. When we return, we'll get to some phone calls. Thanks for waiting out there. 614-292-8513 if you want to join the conversation with Ohio Supreme Court Justice Maureen O'Connor and Ohio Secretary of State Jennifer Bruner. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back with All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
The new film, The Kids Are All Right, stars Julianne Moore and Annette Bening as a lesbian couple whose children have decided to track down their mother's sperm donor. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with director Lisa Cholodenko. Also, journalist Joel Achenbach describes our electricity grid, which is based on outmoded 1960s technology that discourages the use of renewable energy. Join us.
Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon, right here on WOSU 820, NPR News. WOSU Public Media presents a special Chefs in the City coffee tasting at Luck Brothers Coffee House in Grandview. Thursday, July 29th at 10:30 a.m. Join us and sample gourmet coffees and treats and get a rare coffee take-home from Luck Brothers. You'll also be a part of a special WOSU TV production and learn how to brew the perfect cup of coffee. A limited number of tickets are available and on sale now. For more information and to reserve your tickets, go to wosu.org/chefs. And taking a look at the weather forecast, another hot day here in Central Ohio, 88 degrees at 11:40 this morning. Sunny skies today, a high reaching right around 95. There is a slight chance of rain tonight, a low of 71. And then a good chance of rain for Friday, cooler temperatures with a high of 82. Sunny for Saturday and a high of 85. All Sides continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guests, Ohio Secretary of State Jennifer Bruner and Ohio Supreme Court Justice Maureen O'Connor. We're talking about women on the bench, and it's still well below, it's about 25% across the board, 50% in Montgomery County, we learned earlier from Mary McCarty at the Dayton Daily News. What do you think about it? Do you think about what? Were you listening to the hearings for the nomination of Elena Kagan to be an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States? How do you compare them to the hearings recently of now Justice Sonia Sotomayor? Do you think that they're fair? Do you think there's code words that jump out at you and you'd like to talk about? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. And Susan, you're on the air. You'd rather have a progressive male than a conservative female.
Yeah, you know, when I think about the Ohio Supreme Court, yes, we have women on the court, but they're all Republicans. And I'm concerned that judges, they're funded by their party, they're run by their party, and yet when we go to vote for them, the party affiliation is not listed on the ballot. And I think we can overdo the gender thing. I think we can feel like we have balance because we have women on the court, but if we have conservative Republican women on the court, they may not be voting the way that we might want them to vote. So I'm much more concerned with party affiliation, especially at the Supreme Court, Circuit Court level, much more interested in party affiliation than I am gender. So,
which is Justice O'Connor? It's kind of the way you'd like it too.
First of all, I don't believe that a person's political registration should enter into the equation whatsoever. And if that is the belief of the person who's doing the job, the judge, whether it be on the municipal court or on the Supreme Court, they're really betraying their oath and they should not be on the bench. It's judicial philosophy and it's a precedent. And it's context of the statute or the rule or whatever you're asked to interpret and apply. And if you let politics enter into that, you're not doing your job. And I don't – my colleagues are all registered Republican. That was always the complaint, and it was always the characteristic of the court when written about, is the all-Republican Supreme Court. And if that were the case – where your political persuasion, your personal registration mattered, then we would have far more unanimous decisions coming out of the Ohio Supreme Court than the sharply divided decisions that we do have. I oftentimes find myself at odds even with the other women on the court. So it's not a gender. It's not a political party affiliation. It truly is a philosophy and a manner of interpretation. Now, I'm sure the caller is looking at it from a political perspective because we do have political races and there are interest groups that support one candidate over another. And some of those interest groups are political parties. But it's the supporters following the philosophy of the candidate, the member of the judiciary, not the member of the judiciary changing, forming, molding their philosophy in accordance with who their supporters are.
I don't know if it's as big of an issue at the local court level as much as it is at the Supreme Ohio Supreme Court level, but campaign contributions have been a big bone of contention in the races, particularly I think with Alice Roby Resnick's last race and how she was allegedly influenced by the trial lawyers in Ohio because of their big contributions to her campaign. And does that how do you feel about that and the contributions and what they represent beyond the politics?
If you go beyond the politics, we have a system that elects the Supreme Court. In order to get the message out, there has to be the means. The means because it's expensive and it costs money to get your message out.
Especially in Ohio.
There has to be a revenue generated, created. But what is not emphasized when you're talking, when you're having this discussion, is that the court has limits that the donors can donate to the candidate themselves. Doesn't matter if you're a millionaire. It doesn't matter if you're, you know, just your average working Ohioan. There's only a certain amount that you are, a maximum amount that you're able to donate per candidate. And when that information is given to someone who's asked about their concerns, the response is, oh, I didn't know that. Well, that changes things a little bit. Now, what is given to the individual judge or justice pales in comparison to what third parties do in a judicial race. And that is unregulated and unlimited to a certain extent, and the amount that they spend and, you know, who can donate to that. And then in light of the most recent United States Supreme Court decision on campaign contributions, that's the Wild West, as far as I'm concerned, for campaign. And we'll see what happens in 2010.
As far as?
As far as the efforts of third parties.
That to are influence under, the election.
You know, they're not the judges. They're not the candidates right. that are part of that. There can be no collaboration between these independent groups and the candidates' campaign. And when you look at the amount of money that is raised by the individual candidates' campaigns, and by the way, candidates hire people to raise money for them. Candidates do not and cannot solicit.
Judicial candidates.
Judicial candidates cannot solicit for donations, cannot even ask, you know. So the point is that the amount of money that is available to the candidate is very limited in a judicial race.
Jennifer?
The only thing to add to that is that the political parties have to establish separate funds, judicial campaign funds, so that if they're going to spend money on a judicial candidate's race, it has to be spent from that fund. So, and there are limits what can be contributed to that, although they're much larger than for an individual candidate, and then limits as to what the party can spend either in kind or directly on a candidate. But it does remain to be seen what will happen with the Citizens United case, because we don't have a fix either at the federal level or at the state level. So essentially, now even a corporation can spend its dollars independently to promote or to oppose the candidacy of any particular person, including a judge.
Because, as the U.S. Supreme Court's ruled, they're people too.
That's what they said.
That's what they said. 614-292-8513. Ed, you're on the air. You want to talk about the Kagan hearings. Welcome to the show.
Yes. My question is specifically regarding the idea that she doesn't have any experience as a judge. And I know they keep putting Rehnquist up there from the other side saying, well, he didn't have any experience either. And I know some of the judges that we've had on the Supreme Court in the past have been well-known figures but have not necessarily had judicial experience. And I'll hang up and listen, but I wanted to get both of their ideas about whether that is actually a necessity for that, as much or whether the life experience and the empathy and the, I guess, judicial temperament is the word I want to use. What is their idea regarding that idea of experience for a Supreme Court judge?
You know, Jennifer Bruner, you brought up earlier that to run for a judge, common pleas judge, you have to have 6 years' experience. Mm-hmm. So what's the difference?
Well, I think in this case, when you're looking at the Supreme Court of the United States, I think there should be a greater concern for the analytical and the legal skills and experiences. One of the large issues that court looks at are the separation of powers between the legislative, the executive, and the judicial branches of government. And judicial experience is fine and good, and Sonia Sotomayor certainly came up through the ranks at every level. Now we have Elena Kagan, who's never been a judge, but I don't think that in any way minimizes her value to the court, because she brings other perspectives, and you then get an amalgam of seven justices' points of view and discussion in making a decision. And quite frankly, I think a greater concern for the American public is that we have a court that respects that separation of powers.
Justice O'Connor?
I would agree. I don't think that it's necessarily a vital prerequisite to have been a member of a lower court before becoming a member of the court of last resort. In this country, 46 Supreme Courts out of 50, you know, 50 Supreme Courts have members of their court, their courts of last resort, who have had no previous judicial experience. So it's not out of sync or out of the norm as maybe it's being portrayed because of Elena Kagan's factor of not having worn a robe before she would go on the bench. But, you know, they point to the late Chief Justice Rehnquist, but there were so many other examples of members of the court who had not been court, you know, judges, mm-hmm. Federal judges or even state judges previously that have managed to do good participants in the United States Supreme Court. And I know from my perspective on the Ohio Supreme Court, Justice Pfeiffer was never a judge before he became
state
a member
senator.
Of – yes. And his perspective in bringing – or his comments in bringing some of the perspective of the legislative branch to the table for our discussion.
When you say, what were they thinking?
and you know, Justice Kopp has the same background, has been a legislator, but he was also an appellate judge. So we run the gambit from people who have, you know, grown up in the judiciary like Justice Lanzinger, who has served on all four levels of the court, from the municipal court to the Supreme Court, only one in the state history that's ever done that. And so you've got someone who's steeped in judicial tradition and education and performance, and then you have someone else who brings the legislative perspective and someone who brings both the legislative and the judicial perspective. My point is we have so many different and varied experienced people on the court, and put it all together, it really makes for great conferences and great discussions and I think opinions that are that serve the public.
614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. If you want a chance to talk with Ohio Supreme Court Justice Maureen O'Connor or Ohio Secretary of State Jennifer Bruner. Justice O'Connor, you recalled to Miriam McCarty in her story on the Dayton Daily News, the days when courtroom visitors would stare straight at you in the judge's robes and demand, I'm looking at for Judge O'Connor. Where is he? Or are you Judge O'Connor? So I just find that – are you exaggerating to make a point?
No, I'm not. And I'll give you an example. Here's another example. I was in trial, and it was the lunch break, and I had to run home to pick up one of my children. You know, I too had two kids in law school, and so they were young when I was on the bench, and I had to run an errand with one of them, and I happened to be hit by a bus when I was driving home to pick up my son, and the police came, and the police officer said to the bus driver, does the name Judge O'Connor mean anything to you? And he said, oh, my God, is that Judge O'Connor's wife? So, yes, there, you know, throughout the ranks and throughout the years, there's been some pretty humorous examples of people's preconceived notion about what a judge should look like, gender, appearance, and obviously it's not hasn't always been female.
There's this idea that, you know, you can't be too soft to be a judge. You got to be tough. And then you have the stereotype of the cold female judge. She's cold. She's, you know, unfeeling. And it kind of cuts both ways. You can't win. Jennifer?
That's true. I can recall a trial where the lawyer – it was a slip and fall case. And the lawyer was getting so into his case and he was representing the defendant that he – as I would as I would calmly overrule his objection, he would demand to know the reason why, and he would say, basis, what's the basis? And so I finally took him into a sidebar room, and I'd had no other thing to draw on except my own experiences, and I said, you know what? If this was a soccer game, I'd be giving you a yellow card. I said, one more out of you, and I will embarrass you in front of the jury, and I had to do it. It's there is kind of a
– it was irritating him that you weren't getting more emotional.
That is correct, and that I was simply just overruling, and he was getting very hot about it and challenging me in front of the jury, and so I still didn't get emotional in front of the jury because it was my job not to influence the jury. They were making the decision, but when I took him into the sidebar room, I gave him the best example that I knew from my own experience, which was soccer.
You know, I think that it cuts in various directions. I think early on the public was very accepting of women being in the family court or the juvenile court because those were the soft courts. Those were the courts that you had to make decisions about families and children and that sort of thing. And then when women started to be judges in the general division where you were dealing with the capital murder cases and rape cases and really egregious criminal activity, there was a concern, are they going to be able to emotionally handle that kind of a – and so then it becomes, well, if you then hand down a sentence that is commensurate with the crime and it is a hard and harsh sentence because that's what the law provides, sometimes you're branded as a woman as being tough and too tough and whereas a man would just be a good, strong, fair judge. And it cuts both ways. It really does.
A couple years ago, after I wrote about the White House Project, which is an effort to get more women into public office and get more women running for public office, the ultimate obvious goal, putting a woman in the White House, I got a note from a colleague who said, you know, what difference does it make? If women are all, you know, if women are just as good as men, why does it matter that you have a woman instead of a man in office or on the bench? You want to respond to that in closing for this hour?
My response to that is men are equal, but they're not the same. And that is the premise from which you have to look at opportunity and performance for your candidates, those that are running for office and those that are in office. And the respect for the equality, and you have to respect equality but not expect sameness. And I think that concept is grasped and accepted, I think you'll see a different tenor.
Jennifer Bruner?
Well, the just as good as is a very flawed premise because in terms of setting a standard, I don't think a standard needs to be tied to a gender one way or another. But we are different. We have different life experiences because we live in different bodies. But when we're talking about the affording of rights, equality can be many shapes, sizes, colors, backgrounds, and it's what makes us so rich as a country. Our diversity, and especially here in Ohio, our diversity is our strength. And so that should really be something that we elevate because all in all, if we have a government that looks more like its people, I think its people will be more satisfied with its government.
That's all the time we have for this show. I want to say thank you very much to our guests, Ohio Supreme Court Justice Maureen O'Connor. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
And also Ohio Secretary of State Jennifer Bruner. Thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
That's all the time we have for All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820, NPR News.